Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the King of Pack Board meeting. This is a little bit different than what we've done traditionally, so I appreciate everybody making the effort to be here. To give you a little bit of background, we were going to have an emergency application review, which is why we scheduled this meeting, and then that application withdrew. But since we had the meeting scheduled and there was significant activity that took place during the legislative session this year, we felt that it would behoove the board to go ahead and have the meeting and discuss what's going on as a result of some legislative activity and just kind of touch base on a number of those types of items. As you all know, we generally meet every month, and because of the lack of applications, we were going to have a two-month hiatus. And I can't go 2 months without seeing all of your happy faces, so we decided to have this meeting. So, in all honesty, we do appreciate you being here and making the effort. You know, we travel a great distance, and we aim to make this worth your while and hope to have a good discussion. So you are aware, there are no really motionable items intended on the agenda. Open meetings law requires that anything that is moved upon is on the agenda, so you can see what is there. And if there are motions that need to be made on those items, we could entertain those, but I don't foresee that happening. So we'll just play that by ear. More than anything, this is again is an opportunity for the board to discuss what's going on with the number of projects, what's going on as a result of the legislature, and just get up to speed and have a discussion about that. There was some discussion about the need for a closed session of the board. Whether or not that happens, again, remains to be seen. I don't anticipate the need to go into a closed session. I think we can discuss the things we need to discuss and get everyone up to speed on what's going on without that. But again, if there is a need, it is acceptable for a member of the board to make a motion and have that discussion and go into closed session if you need. We have legal representation here, and so they will advise us if that's eligible and appropriate when we get to that point. So that kind of is an outline of why we're here and what we hope to accomplish. This is a much more casual meeting than we are accustomed to having. Again, I hope to have more of an open discussion. We don't have applicants here. We won't be entertaining any of those type of things, so it'll be less formal. And hopefully we can have some good conversations and move forward in a positive direction. I do think it would be helpful, and it was recommended by Mr. Galecki, that we do some introductions. Since we do have a smaller group, it would be nice if we go through and just find out who's who. So I will start, and we'll move Candace and just go around the room. My name is Keith Eaton, the chairman of the Permanent Community Impact Board. An employee of the Department of Workforce Services Housing and Community Development Division. And so I work here in this beautiful building in this lovely neighborhood, so welcome to my neighborhood.
Candy Towers, I am with Housing and Community Development. I'm the funds manager for the Permanent Community Impact Fund.
And I'm Chris Reed, I'm the Administrative Assistant for Housing and Community Development.
I'm from Sunshine, George, with Hints of World, representing UDOT Commission.
My name is Jared. I'm Tammy County Commissioner, and I'm representing
Chips
County AOG.
Ron Winterson, County Commissioner. I represent the Univation AOG.
Greg Galecki, I represent the Water Quality Board.
Good morning. Martin Key, UNIT County Commissioner, representing UNIT County.
I'm Brian Carver with Air River Association of Governments.
I'm Nathan Hall with the Division of Drinking Water.
Jim Burr with Champion Company.
Jeff Holt, Bank of Montreal.
Matt, let's go with you and work our way forward.
Thank you, Parker.
I'm
going to be able to
come up with you.
Brian Martin with Johnson and Engineering.
Eric Johnson with Blaisdell Church in Johnson.
Matt Bogle with Blaisdell
Church. Commissioner Peter Ogden, Sudbury County.
Malcolm Madison, Sudbury County.
Chad Westbrook, Community Impact Fund Program.
Gail Gardner with Housing and Community Development Division.
From the AG's office, and I'm really pleased to introduce Wade Faraway to you today. As many of the board members know, I've been coming along to help be a backup person to Tom on this board, and recently the decision was made in our office to transition Tom to other duties was assigned, and so Wade and I will be taking over representation of the board. Your usual Thursday meetings conflict with some other meetings that I'm required to attend, so your the face of the AG's office will probably be Wade from now on, but we'll both be providing you with a representation. Wade, say something about yourself.
I am Wade Faraway. Some of you know me. I'm the legislative affairs attorney for the AG's office. They've changed my title to government affairs attorney for the AG's office, and I think that's why I'm here.
Jerry Potter, Carbon County Commission, representing Carbon County.
Bruce Adams, San Juan County Commissioner, representing Southeastern Utah AOG.
Jonathan Hardy, Director of the Housing and Community Development Division.
Jerry Hampson, City Attorney.
Thank you, one and all. We appreciate that. Hopefully that's helpful to know who's who and who you represent. A warm welcome to Mr. Faraway. We're happy to have him with us, and promise that this will be entertaining and educational throughout. Look forward to working with you. As is custom, Candace would like to take a few minutes to brief the board on some things, so we'll turn some time over to her for that.
Upcoming meeting date and location. May 5th is the next meeting date. May 5th meeting will be at the DEQ building, the multi-agency state office building, MASAB. Mm-hmm. The June 8th and 9th policy retreat will be in Monticello, Utah. The 8th will also be the funding meeting for the third trimester of fiscal year 2016. July will stand, I believe it's July 7th is the next meeting. There is a change in September, just so that you note it on your calendars. CID's meetings are usually the first Thursday of every month, with the exception of June and December, which have conflicts with members on this board. Well, September also has a conflict. There will be the Energy Summit in the Uinta County Energy Summit in Bernal. That's on the 1st of September, so the CID meeting will be on the 8th of September. So make note of that. You do not have a financial review today. Pardon?
The 8th of September.
Stay tuned. Could be here. The financial review, we usually tell you what the fund balance will be. Right now, you know, with the repayment of loans, we're kind of at parity. As much money in loan repayments is coming in as new money. But it looks like the infrastructure fund was a good idea. There is some set aside in there. And with the applications that have been submitted, it looks like you'll have some hard decisions to make. But it surprises me, because at the time we got to the end of trimester two, we had enough money to fund what all the good applications. It may well be that again.
So we're living paycheck to paycheck?
We're living paycheck to paycheck. No. Next application deadline is June 1st. We'll know a little bit about those applications that will be requesting funding for the first trimester of 2017. The trimester does end with our June policy retreat, and that will give us a more definitive idea of what the board's past year has looked like and what the future year may have in store. The price of oil is going up, not much, but it's better than, I mean, at $27 a barrel, that was lean time. I think it's just pushing 40 as we speak. And that is where we are right now.
Brief briefing.
I can go on to board member terms, but let's do the next.
I apologize, Claudia. I did the introduction out of order, and I had to mess everything up. That's on me. The chair will entertain a motion on the minutes.
You know, I just have a question about what numbers are. So
it's... I don't know. It's on the inside instead of the outside. The board should be advised that Claudia is not the only person who can speak to the minutes. Just want you to know that is not an official or unofficial policy of this board.
And also be advised that if you do, you give looks.
Well, let me just say that when I first came on this board, there was a little issue that related to minutes. And since that time, I have learned that the minutes reflect the professionalism, the credibility, the intent of this board, and it's the official record. It is the official record. So I have personally thought it very important to read them and read them carefully, because it's a reflection of us. So the one that I was just, it just reads funny to me, and it's at the bottom of page 7. Yeah. And it says, the board indicated that part of the motion would include reporting and oversight. Bi-weekly, that's the key word, bi-weekly report will be given weekly. I was just confused. So what does the bi-weekly term mean? What do you mean? So, I don't know. I read it funny to me, and I wasn't sure just what they were supposed to do.
So the reports are coming every other week, right?
So then I would take out the weekly on the second one. Does that make sense?
Yes.
More things. Page 10. We have a duplication. Last sentence down there. Chairman indicated to confirm that it could be perceived that special consideration was being given to an entity, any entity.
Which page?
10. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Second to the last line, part of that sentence.
Okay, we'll take out any entity.
Maybe he wants to know just emphasize any entity.
I do like that. Maybe he did.
Just let me emphasize that that was good. Maybe we should put one more in there.
Maybe all and my family.
With that, I make a motion that we accept the minutes described.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Witches.
I don't know if that'll stand.
It was a bold move. And you did get looks.
I'm sitting next to her.
Make it more than looks, that way. And Mr. Galecki, you have a second?
Sure.
Any other questions or comments? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Me. I wanted Claudia to make the motion.
Let the record reflect that the Commissioner McKee.
No.
Thank you for that. Candace, you wanted to take a minute and talk about board member terms.
Yes.
This is the term of service.
This is the term of service. Just by way of information, there are positions on this board that are appointments from Water Resources, Water Quality, and UDOT. Those are appointments. Those are at the will of Water Quality, Resources, and UDOT. All other elected officials serve two terms. There are two board members whose term was expiring. One was Jim Matson, but he has served one term, and I received word from 5 counties that he will serve a second term. It is their choice, and they can't go good. We maintain Jim Matson. Claudia Jarrett has served 2 terms. She will be going off the board July. And because each board member can serve 2 terms, 2 consecutive terms, and we can admonish that she goes and participates on another board that will appoint her to this board, but her term is finished here. Other terms that will be coming up, we won't have any more changes, but be aware in July 2017 there are terms that will be expiring, either first or second term, and whomever represents this board, the good board, we just want you to always be prepared and always know, and perhaps lend your information, integrity, and your institutional knowledge as we go forward, so that this board does continue to maintain the integrity of the board and we have good representation. We will miss Claudia.
I am glad to pass on the motioning of the minister.
So, Claudia, is it my understanding that you will serve in the May and June meeting?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So, plenty of time for cheerful hold on.
Yes. We do not have word on three names that should come from the six county AOG, but they're deciding.
So the process is the AOG makes recommendations with three candidates.
Right.
And the governor's office then makes the determination.
The legislature actually has to approve.
Yeah, the governor makes, you know, governor makes appoints the Senate.
It's like a Supreme Court justice.
You can, you know, an AOG can say, this is our first, second, and third choices. So the AOG does have input and effect on who is appointed. But then the governor makes that selection, sends it to the Senate, and they approve.
In keeping with the Supreme Court, we're going to wait for a new legislature.
We're just waiting. Anything else on the session? Everyone else is staying for us.
Yep.
Wonderful. The next item is the discussion of the legislation, the legislative session, and those things that affected this fund and this board, which is really the purpose of our meeting today. Again, this will be rather free-flowing. And somewhat open, so feel free to chime in as appropriate. I thought to get things started, it might be beneficial since we have the privilege of having Senator Osterlin with us, if he could come in and kind of give us the 30,000-foot overview of things that transpired and how those might affect this fund and rural Utah in general. Trying to get things going since he has the interest. So we invite him to come forward and tell us what we missed or what we wish we missed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A week or so ago, Keith called and asked if I would come in and give a little bit of an overview on some of the legislative items that we dealt with that affect the board, so I'm always more than happy to do that. I want to say how much I admire the work of this board. You guys do a great job, a great service to the rural part of the state, a big part of that rural area that I represent in my Senate district. But, you know, anything that's nice in the rural part of the state, you guys have probably been involved with. And so it's been a tremendous impact on especially those counties that are impacted by mineral meat extraction. So thank you for your service. I asked Eric Johnson to come up with me this morning to maybe be able to answer some questions, if there are some, on a couple of the pieces of legislation that I'm going to mention. The first one that we dealt with, I actually asked Eric to help me with the idea and make some suggestions on drafting on the Ethics Act revisions. That one was to address some of the issues that this board has had, and not just this board, but other boards, where there are appointments made by the governor or someone else that where elected officials serve on a board representing their county or their service district or their whatever organization entity that they represent, whether or not they have a conflict of interest when it comes to voting on an issue that affects their county. Knowing that there has been some question on that, we wanted to make that as clear as possible in code, so we drafted a very simple short bill that basically says that unless you have a personal conflict, unless you have something that would benefit you personally from your vote on an issue, that the conflict doesn't exist. So we wanted to make that clear that unless you do have a personal conflict that affects you personally or someone in your family, the statute is drafted and that is covered. You don't have a conflict. And so Eric Johnson worked on this issue and done quite a bit of research on it. And we talked about getting into more detail and really getting into a lot, but in the bill itself. But actually, it's very simple the way it's drafted. And Eric, do you want to elaborate a little on that one?
Just as background, there are three ethics acts in the state of Utah. There's the Municipal Ethics Act, a County Ethics Act, and then a General Public Officers Ethics Act. One that was amended was the General Public Officers Ethics Act. Before that amendment, all three ethics acts talked about that they applied to conflicts between public duties and personal interests. However, the Municipal Ethics Act and County Ethics Act talked about that in more than the General Public Officers Ethics Act. And so all that happened, the amendment just clarified what was already in the Act. In the purpose statement of the General Officers Ethics Act, it said that its purpose was to address conflicts between public duties and personal interest, and so we just again reiterated that later in the enabling language so that it would be clearer where it had been unclear.
Well, any questions on that one? It was fairly simple, and we wanted it to be as simple as we could keep it.
If I could just comment on that, thank you, Senator. That's valuable because we have had discussion in here in the past, and I think clarifying that and putting that so that there isn't ambiguity in any way has been very valuable. So thank you very much for doing that.
You bet.
Can I ask
some
specific examples then? So if we are on a specific board for a special service district that comes before with an application, are we not in confidential vote on that? For instance, we have a lot of water district in Sam. Many of the commissioners serve on those boards as a commissioner. So we have in the past kind of said that we abstained from that vote because we were directly a member of that board. So is that an effort to violation if we vote on that or not? I mean, I really would like some help with the specifics of personal benefit.
Let me ask the question to make sure I'm understanding. Questions. So you mean when that special service district would come before this body, is that what you're referring
yes.
to?
Yes.
So you're on the board of the body making application
yes.
here.
Yes.
First of all, you may recuse yourself if you elect to. The question is, are you required to recuse yourself? Under the Public Officers Ethics Act, the General State Act, as amended, unless you have a personal interest that is not shared by the public generally, you would be able to act on that application as a CID board member. Let me give an example that a real life example that came up not too long ago with this board. Okay, it was an application from a water district. Commissioner McKee, if you don't want me to go too far, but your son is the general manager yes. of that water district, okay? And so Commissioner McKee voluntarily said, okay, I'm going to recuse myself, and that probably was proper under the Act as amended to say, okay, there's a potential personal interest for Commissioner McKee in that water district's application for CID board, okay, that is not shared by the public generally because his son is the general manager. However, I don't see that it would necessarily be the same if Santee County were to have an application to this board, and you're asking for funds for a project that benefits the county generally, but not necessarily you personally, then...
Well, they do.
But not in a way that isn't shared by the general public. And let me say this. In researching how ethics acts have been, the Utah General Ethics Act has not been judicially vetted a lot of times, okay? But in researching how other state ethics acts have been interpreted in their states, they have consistently said it's only a conflict that would require the recusal if there is a personal interest not shared by the public generally. And that is language that you see come up in judicial decisions fairly often. And so that essentially is what the amendment was intended to.
It's funny, Phil Grader, because in Ms. McGee's case, well, it's still helping the water district in general.
The difference is his son receives a paycheck from that district as opposed to a board member who would not. And so there is a personal interest.
The thing that occurred to me, it's possible that his evaluation, his salary and everything, maybe, you know, they may look at those things as some of the things that happens in there, and maybe it benefits the family in some way. It's better for me not to be involved in that.
Yeah, and I will say, even in other states where perhaps their ethics acts are a little more, have in the past have been a little more explicit, and where there has been more judicial vetting, that doesn't mean that there's never questions to the rest.
So if you're a member of that specific water district, could you vote on that because you're a part of it in general?
Okay, so for example, yes. Let's say that water district, which does serve Commissioner McKee's home, he's not on the board of that water district, and his son is not the general manager of that water district. In that case, I think it's very clear that he would be allowed to act on that application. Even though he receives a benefit, it's just the benefit as a member of the public general.
If anyone has a question about whether they have a personal conflict, and if they, you know, they can always call me before the meeting and, you know, can discuss it with attorney client, so feel free.
Yeah, I think that's great, Kevin. You have a tremendous resource there in the Attorney General's office, so if there's a question, that's always, I think, great counsel. Yeah, the one thing that we wanted to just address and make sure that it would make no sense for the governor to appoint someone to represent their county on the board and then them not be able to act on an application from their county. That's quite the face of why they were why they're appointed to serve. And so I think that this helps us clear that up, and we wanted to do as much as we could there. But I think that's great counsel to be able to go to the Attorney General's office for advice on any conflicts that might arise.
Especially when you come from smaller areas, right? It's possible that you know everybody. Or that you search the genealogical family tree far enough, you may be related to everybody in the whole town. So just feel free to call me if you have any concerns.
It is a little bit of a two-edged sword, though, because being on the board, I think it's an expectation by the applicant that you vote for their project, and you know, help it out, you're on the board. But for the others in the audience and the other applicants, it may appear that it's an unfair advantage to them because they don't have that inside vote, if you will, on the board. So I guess it's just going to have to be a personal choice whether you think that you should recuse or vote. So anyway, thank you for the explanation. That was very helpful.
I think one of the things that's important to remember is the consistency and precedent when these situations come up. I think that was one of the issues that was brought up in the past is, does your vote, I mean, are you giving more favorable terms as a board member to an applicant that whether you have a personal financial interest or not, you have a vested interest because it's from your area. So the issue of consistency and fairness across all applicants probably the standard with which the maze are going forward to make sure that we're implementing this the right way, because I agree with the intent of what the law is set for. So to make sure that nobody, I think that's where people may bring up, you know, it appears, even though in the law there's not a conflict, people may have those types of feelings about a project maybe getting preferential treatment. So if we just keep consistency of fairness across the way we treat project applicants, and I know our staff does a great job of reminding us of the history of what we've done with certain things, and I think that's an important point to remember going forward.
Can I just one more thing that goes into this, because, you know, it is kind of, to me, it's an interesting situation here, because, you know, even as we're appointed to this board, we're appointed in different forms. As you mentioned, there's state officers, waterfalls, you know, different ones are appointed different ways. Jay and I, our appointments are a little bit different than everybody else's appointment. Well, I'm appointed here because I represent the largest producing county in the state. He's appointed because he's the second largest producer in the state. And then if you read federal and state law, it says priority funding should go to the area from the priority of funding should go to the area from where those impacts were generated. So it seemed very strange for Jay and I not to be able to vote on a project coming from our area. And so I think it creates that balance. So anyway, I just mentioned that as well.
If it would be helpful during the retreat or at any time, I have a pretty nifty PowerPoint that goes through the Public Officers Ethics Act. And just to be clear, right, while you're sitting in this room, you are public officers under the State Ethics Act. When you're doing your other jobs, when you're not in this room and you're wearing your other hats as county commissioners and things, you've got your county municipal ethics act. So I have a 15-minute PowerPoint that I can go through all the different things.
Or
I can just send it to you.
Mr. Chair, if I could maybe just follow up on what Mr. Hardy said, I think just a perspective. For example, Commissioner Jarrett, you represent the 6th County AOG, and let's say there's an application from Sevier County. That would be the expectation, since they're within that AOG, that they would, you know, coming from your area, they would have your support. I don't see a reason why Santee County should be penalized and not have that same support simply because that's the county that elected you. It seemed almost the opposite. That it would be unfair that those that elected you should then lose that voice on this board.
So that bill has been signed by the governor and will be in effect here very shortly. I'm going to just mention one other bill really briefly because I think it could have some effect on potentially some projects that may come before this board sometime in the future that was not signed into law. We late in the session, just before the session started, which is late in getting a bill going to try to get it drafted and before the legislature, we started working on a public-private partnership act. And there are other acts across the country dealing with public-private funding relationships that have been pretty successful. I attended a meeting with the Salt Lake Chamber that had a number of representatives from folks who have been involved in the funding of big projects across the country. Everything from roads to water and sewer projects, the pipeline, all of the big projects that happen across the country. More and more we're seeing the need for a tool to be able to have public and private partnerships where we start dealing with projects that may have both of those options available to them. So we started working on that and got through the Senate, both committee and and got it to the point where we had a bill drafted. There were some amendments that we started working on. It got late in the session. It was fairly complicated, and we didn't want to try to rush it through in the last few days of the session because it does have some importance, and we need to continue to work on it a little bit more. So that's one that I have asked that we take a look at during the interim, and we'll be assigning that one to interim for study here very shortly. And we'll continue to work on that one. We'd love to have input on that bill as we start moving that forward and thinking about that and looking at what other states have done. I think it's just another tool for all of us on projects that may come before the state as we look at maybe, for example, a road project where there could be both a public and private benefit, and maybe you have a toll section on it where there are a lot of resource trucks, coal trucks, oil and gas trucks, or whatever they're using the road. They may pay a toll, and that could be financed differently than the public portion of it. It could also be have a public use. So just a heads up on that one, and I'd be more than happy as a sponsor of that bill to have any input that you may have on that one as we start moving forward with that idea. It's got really great support from the business community, and it looks like something that would be a very useful tool as the state looks at some projects maybe out in the future way. So just heads up on that one.
Senator, yes. Along that line, does that mean that if they brought in those funds that, say, an applicant comes here and they have that partnership, are they still qualified to come here for that? Because a lot of times we look at projects that it might benefit the private sector, so we turn it away. So will that be changing some of the criteria here?
Yeah, I think that's the idea, is to give us a tool where we can say, using the toll road, I don't know if that's the best example, but using that one for an example, where we say, all right, it's going to be a $10 million project, and we think that the use on the road is going to be 60% coal trucks or oil trucks or whatever the resource might be that might be affected. And so maybe we can have an applicant go to a funding board like the CID or another funding board and make an application and say, all right, we think that 40% of this traffic on this road is going to be public. It's public use. It'll be a public road. It's owned by the state because it is a road. And we think it ought to be eligible for some public funding, but we also believe that we can get some private funding to cover that other section, that 60% used by whoever the entity is that's going to be using it, and they can pay a toll, and we can actually finance that in a partnership where we have private financing as well as public financing. There's some intricacies and some difficulties that arise in trying to make sure that there is definitely tied to the private part of the road a payback. And if there's any kind of a default, the public doesn't end up holding the bag for the portion that's defaulted. So we're working through those issues. We don't have to reinvent the wheel on this. There are some good examples out there in the rest of the country. And we just think that we can create something here that will give us another tool and maybe another option as we get into certain kinds of projects.
May I chime in that a public-private partnership act would not alter the federal restrictions on mineral lease funds that can only be used for planning for construction and maintenance of public public projects and for public services. Okay, so that would remain in place. That would not be altered. But let me give you an example from outside the state of Utah of what that means. So just across the state line in Rio Blanco County, Colorado, they have the electric by over 80% vote approved the county to construct a broadband system that would bring the internet to every home in that rural county. It's about a $12 million project. They're getting about a quarter of that money from federal Middle East funds. Once constructed, the county will then contract with a private internet service provider to provide the internet service over that system. That public-private partnership will not disqualify that project from receiving federal Middle East funds.
That's a much better example than the one I used.
Appreciate that.
Okay, good. The other piece of legislation that really affects this board, I didn't sponsor this bill and didn't have as much influence and participation in this bill as I did the others. Commissioner Potter and others can probably give you a better description of what is in the bill on the coal port. The idea of that bill was that we were going to try to create a tool and actually help this board be able to use the mineral lease funds that are received by the board to be able to fund this project, and this could be a tool that could also be used on other projects. This may be maybe a model or a tool that, that maybe other projects could also use as we get into the future and see all of the infrastructure needs that we have out there. And so my thinking on that one, on this particular bill, is that that the value of it is that it is just another tool. It allows actually for the state to be able to receive the mineral lease funds from the Community Impact Board over a couple of year period of time. That was acted on by this board, and $53 million that I think is the total that was set aside for this project could actually be traded, very similar to what the state of Utah does with transportation funding, where there are federal transportation funds that have a lot of the federal red tape and restrictions on it that make it very difficult for locals to be able to use those federal funds. And so over the course of years, the Transportation Commission has allowed the trade of those funds, those federal funds, for state dollars. So kind of following that model, this bill allows the tool for the state to be able to receive those mineral lease funds that that come from the federal government back to the state, or actually funds are generated out in our producing county for this project, and then the state it isn't state money, it isn't taxpayer dollars that fund this by any means. That was a misunderstanding that I think was kind of put out there, and it seems like every time somebody asks me about this project, they say, why are we spending taxpayer dollars? Well, it really isn't. As you all know very well, it's mineral lease dollars, and it's just money that's generated out in our producing counties, and so we allow that to be able to be traded, and the state uses the money to be able to do the project, reimburses the CIB board through the loan process, and the loan that you would be granting out, you would be getting the money back for future projects, just like you do on the loans that you give on any of the projects that you may approve. So that bill, we started working on, I think, pretty early in the session. Senator Adams, of course, ran that bill, who's a former member of the Transportation Commission and has dealt with these kinds of issues extensively. Of course, Jeff Holt, who is the former chair of the Transportation Commission and a longtime member of this board. They were very involved in that process, but we also had a team of our legislative advisors that was involved in that process as well. And I think Mr. Potter or Jeff Holt could probably do a much better job of describing and answering questions on that bill than I can.
Could I ask just one question on that, if I could, Senator? On the transportation funds, I know out in our area they do that, but I think there's a 15% discount when we change that. Now, I know our group feels like it's still a very good deal because it costs so much more money to do a project when you have to use the federal dollars for all of the nonsense they build into some of this stuff. But in any case, in this case, would there be the 15% discount?
No, there's no discount on this one because it is local money actually coming from the counties that's kind of funneled through, and so it's a paper transaction. It really is what it amounts to, and so there really isn't a lot involved with it. So there's no discount applied on the funds at all. And we did have that discussion very briefly, and frankly, there just wasn't anybody that thought that there should be any kind of a discount applied on this kind of a project on mineral lease funds. So none there. None intended.
Mr. Chairman, we do have Jeff Holt and also Kim Burr who have been asking as counsel for our transaction. I wonder if it would be okay to invite them up at this time and if we can give some more detail as far as those transactions.
Mr. Johnson, Senator Oakland, thank you very much for that overview. We appreciate it.
Thanks for your work.
Mr. Holt, if you'd like to come forward, we'd be anxious to hear.
Mr. Chairman, if I might too, maybe back us up just a little bit and give a little bit of background here and establish some premise. First of all, let me thank the board for their patience over this last year. Part of what we have been going through is to try and make sure that this particular project on the Bolt Terminal was something that would allow this board to go forward in other projects that would be similar, and to make sure that we were on firm ground as far as anything that this board would do. I hope you know how much I value what this board does for rural Utah. And as a major producer, I'm always concerned about where our dollars are and where they're going. But what we're going to see today is somewhat reflected back to Chairman Heaton's vision and also going back to Gordon's vision when we talked about deferred, not compensation, but deferred gratification, as we looked at how rural Utah, particularly in this case eastern Utah, could gain some ground both economically but also from a political nature. We are far outnumbered, as you know, representatively with what happens on the Wasatch Front comparatively to all of us in rural Utah. And so by combining together in not only a six-county organization, which really isn't this discussion, but also in this type of an environment, we feel that we put ourselves in a better position to have the sustaining employment and the sustaining economies that we need. And because of the mineral lease monies, I think this board has done wonderful things over the years. I look in my own county, when I look at the state as we travel, and I see the good that is done here, that would not happen, and I think Senator Oakland would agree, the legislative process would not develop our communities like what we are developing them from internally, basically. And so this is really where it started. As a board, we at that point in time said, okay, we had a little bit more money, we started setting that aside, and we went through the rulemaking process and set up the infrastructure portion of what the CID could do. And those monies that were set aside originally started with the UN Railway. Those were the monies that we were acting upon when we requested the $53 million because the railroad had been determined whether it was or not that it was not going to be built. And so we have also since that time made two other allocations into that fund. But when the four counties brought the application to the board, it was for a fully permitted project, which the Port of Oakland, again, which is a bulk terminal, was fully permitted. It was waiting for the final approvals as far as the lease takedown from the city. But at the same time, it was permitted. And that's a project that's been being worked on for over 10 years with the $50 million of money already put into the project to not only develop but shore up the land there on that port. And so it was very viable. Many of you took the opportunity to go out and physically see what was going on in the Bay Area there. And it's very, very impressive, the facilities that were being put forward. And so that's why we came with that initial application, was we had those monies set aside and it was a fully permitted project. Over this period of time, while we've been running this silent, we have been in that process of seeing where our negotiations would take us. And also so that when we came back, we would have a full project that we could start to explain and go through the process with you. So as we go forward, and please ask us questions as we go along, but let me just make a couple of other observations as we go. This is my personal opinion, and so I don't want it to be reflected as a board opinion, but part of the problem that we've had in the timing and the length of time that it takes any of us to get things done in our counties and in our communities is that there's a very, I would say, upheaval of personal opinion that applies from our special interest groups. I've determined that there's a great difference between environmentalism and sensationalism. I would recognize that each of you around this table and many in the audience here are truly environmentalists, that we care about our communities, we care about our resources. The sensationalism comes when we see what was done in press as far as this particular project and Senate Bill 246. And so I hope to address many of those issues that were wrongly reported, wrongly printed, and give you clarity as far as where we are. I don't know why it is so hard to believe that myself as an elected official representing 19,000 citizens in Carbon County, why it's hard to believe that what I say is true compared to what the special interest groups or others would print or report on. So through the legislative session, there was a lot of that, and I want that to be very clear today, that we're here to represent what the reality of and what this project can really mean. So two things that really play into this. One that Senator Oakland already addressed, that this is not a use of tax dollars. And we'll explain that in much more detail on what the bill does for not only this project, but for other things that the CID would do. The other thing that I want to be very clear on is that Jeff Holt does not represent the four counties that made the application. He is not under contract to us. And as you very well know, he was a member of this board. He's had great influence in the state of Utah. And he is a friend of this board and a friend to the state of Utah, even though his job is taking him to New York. I know that he still has a love of Utah here. And so that was misreported. And that is not the case. And he can explain his own role and who he represents in this process. But those are two things that we really need to be sure that we clarify. The other thing is that when we talk about coal, we talk about what does that really mean environmentally and from our nation itself. This nation was really built upon the backs of energy, of coal and particularly steel. And so here are a few facts about coal that are not reported, that are misreported. First of all, that in the U.S., half of the U.S. electricity in the United States is generated by coal-fired power. That's much higher in the state of Utah. It's above 60%, nearly 70%. in the state. 9 out of every 10 tons of coal that is mined is used for domestic electric energy. Last night as I came through the canyon lake from Price over into Utah County, the windmills weren't turning, it was dark, and I thought, you know, if it wasn't for fossil fuel power, particularly coal and gas, you'd all be in the dark. You'd all be cold, you'd all be really hot. And so there is a transition, and renewables have a place in our society. But the war on coal and the attacks that it is under is unfounded and unfair in every way. Every person in the United States uses 3.7 tons of coal annually. So if you're an environmentalist, every person in the United States uses 3.7 tons of coal a year in their daily lives in some form. You can't look around this room and not see things that coal is impacted. And coal is used for the coking process that makes the steel. Look at the steel in this room. It takes 2 tons of coal to make 1 ton of coking material. And you cannot make steel without the carbon that comes through that coking process. You cannot make windmills without steel. And you cannot make solar panels without steel and without petroleum-based products. So it is very foolish to say that you do not have to have those kind of resources. Yes, use them responsibly, but coal touches our lives in every way. And you just can't get around that at this point in time. Coal is an affordable source of power, fuel, and it's per million BTU. It is the lowest cost in generating heat and electricity. And it historically averages less than 1/4 of the price of petroleum and natural gas. Now, natural gas is at a low, and our power companies are jumping on that. But it really makes me wonder what's going to happen when gas goes back up and what those power rates will look like. So coal is also used in the production of paper. It's used in the production of cement. And it's used in many other resources around the world. I know that there's a big concern about the CO2 emissions that come from all burning of fossil fuels. And that's why we've had such an issue with the Clean Power Plan and the regional haze issues, is that the restrictions that are being put on by this administration are not meetable based upon what they're trying to do in any of its forms. And so I guess if we want to go back to living in caves and not having transportation, that is where some of that policy really is short-sighted, and I really think takes us back. The medical field in themselves look at what we have because of modern technology, powered by energy, powered by resources that come, you know, from Mother Earth. So, in regards to the CO2 issue, global warming is talked about all the time, but they never talk about the natural sources and the natural cycles of CO2. One of the studies that I read from a leading research group suggested that 3 to 5% of the CO2 that is actually emitted into our atmosphere comes from us, the human race, and our uses of energy and so forth around. The other portion of the CO2 is a natural reoccurring cycle within the earth, the oceans, the trees, the vegetation, and how it comes in and how it is used. Talking about the polar caps, various history of how those caps expand and how they shrink based upon the temperatures of the earth. But it's also unclear on how those temperatures happen, going clear back to those ice ages. And so it is as much material as there is, that there is an issue, and I believe we need to be careful. There's also that much more issue, or equal to, that talks about really the impact of the natural sources of CO2. So we're cleaning our coal, we're cleaning our air, we're cleaning all these other things. But even if we put in all the restrictions and did away with fossil fuels, it would make a minuscule impact on what the CO2 emissions are throughout the world.
Jay, can I ask a quick question?
Please.
My understanding is that, I don't know if all of you talk coal, but if you talk a bit more about the relative cleanliness of Utah coal versus other coal from other sources, that's what you heard mentioned.
You bet.
Maybe you're going to touch on that, but...
No, it's a perfect segue into that. Utah coal is traditionally, it's a hard bituminous coal. It's low in sulfur, and the BTU value in it is much higher than almost every place in the world. And so for every one ton of Utah coal replaces literally two tons of poor quality coal in the world cycle. So through exporting or using our own coal, we're actually cleaning up the use of bad fossil fuels and bad material in coal. One of the countries that would be interested in the export said, do the world a favor, sell us your coal, ship it to us, because you should see what we're burning. So as third world countries begin to industrialize, we have that ability to be part of that solution. Also, the technologies, particularly with coal-fired power plants, their scrubber houses, or their bag houses, their scrubbers and so forth, are taking care of the SO2, the sulfurs and the NOxes that are coming through, and the particulates. And technology will continue to change. There's companies out there working now. If our fossil fuel, particularly coal, had had the subsidies that wind and solar had, we probably would have a much cleaner source even now. When I grew up in Price and in the Carbon County area, I remember coming into the valley and how coal is used. And you look at the stacks that are now still burning coal, and you don't see what was there even 20, 30, 40 years ago. So we have come a long, long ways in the use of coal. So not to make this a total discussion about coal, but going back to the Ford project and why it's so critical. It's been reported that this is a coal port. This is not a coal port. This is a bulk commodity on the terminal that is on the old Army base in Oakland. The specific site is a 30-acre parcel, and in that 30-acre parcel, that is where the Army shipped their bulk product out, including coal and including other product. We look at this as an opportunity for the state of Utah because it can have soda ash and potash and hay and salt and any other mineral ore that might need or have a market internationally, and we have an export opportunity. Coal is certainly a part of that, and this becomes a statement of interstate commerce, not so much of what is the material going through. For a terminal to be successful, they need to have access to all commodities. And so we look at our involvement. Yes, we're very interested in what the coal side would be. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that as we go through some of the process of what it means to these four Utah counties. But I think at this point in time, it would be very appropriate to hear from Jeff and let him define where he's at. I'd also have our legal counsel here. We'd like to speak a little bit about why we went to the legislature, how we ended up there, and let you understand a little bit better about those processes.
You really need to write this in
an article. You think they publish what I say?
Yeah. It
does need to be said because there is another true side to the story. Thank you, Clay.
The paper's not interested in the truth.
I'm a subscriber to the
Tribune.
You send it to me and
I'll know. Perfect. They're interested in spelling. The sensationalism spells.
Well,
I think Commissioner
Barr
is great.
I have done my part.
I think you're more truthful than you have been.
All right.
Thanks.
What a follow that one.
Yeah, that's what it's. You know, it's been a year. We were here a year ago. You know, lots happened. And you might ask, you know, where did this year the opposition that we've seen is understood. I understand it more than most. I represent courts, and so in my day-to-day job, I represent a lot of courts. And I built my court practice on the West Coast. That's the front. That's the fight. That's where the fight happens with respect to this particular product. If they can draw the line on export, they can shut the mine down. And that's the answer to all of this fight. So you can imagine when news comes out that the state of Utah wants to set up a multi-commodity terminal on the West Coast, and frankly, as you all recall, we were looking at Mexico at one point in time. We mentioned it, thought we ought to go and take a look at it. And it was frankly because I didn't think there was much likelihood to find a place we could get permitted. When we found, when they made themselves known to us that there was an option available on this terminal, it was pretty stunning. And to be in an absolute straight geographic line to that spot means that our product is the favored product that goes through the terminal. As you all know, it's all about cost per ton mile on the railroad. I mean, we might be able to ship it out of Alabama, but we can't rail it to Alabama to get it out of there. There's lots of coal terminals and capacity in Alabama. That's one of the biggest coal ports in the United States. The problem is the rail cost to get it there. So it's really, both products are all about cost per ton mile and getting from point A to point B. So our natural gateway is just the geography we live with here in the state. So the way the rail lines are set up, that's what we're focused on. When we came last April, what we asked was we had a short leash to demonstrate ourselves and make it known that we had our money available. We were ready to enter into some sort of a negotiation and make this project happen. We wanted to tie it up. We wanted to make sure that there was some discussion. Oh, and I need to state right off the bat. At that time, we talked about how I could best help. In a couple of these projects that you may have heard about in some of the larger infrastructure, because I am representing the counties. There's an oil pipeline that you talked about that I'm representing a couple of counties on a heated oil pipeline. My bank and my infrastructure group, we're representing on that and running processes for that. The second project is Sevier County on behalf of what I think will eventually be a few counties has hired the bank to represent them on the short line rail down through to Stanton to Sevier. But when it came to this, we noodled with it. And one of the issues was, how do we make sure that we raise the other $200 million that needs to get raised to match up with the state's investment to make the project happen? And it was clear to me that was a very, very important piece of the project that had to get done. Given the constraints and the issues and all of the pressures from all of the different areas, it was clear to me that I needed to represent the terminal operating company to make sure the project itself happened. So in discussion with the counties, we talked about it. It was determined I could not represent both. That was clear as a bell, and my own internal counsel with the bank said, absolutely, have to make it clear. So we took the role as representing and becoming a financial advisor to the project, and our specific task, or to the terminal operator, and our specific task is to raise that $200 million at the appropriate time to then make this all work. As you know, the private investors that have to come into this will do a tremendous amount of diligence on the project. And I think one of the fronts that was opened up at the legislature this year with the press and others was, number one, I think the taxpayer dollar issue was talked about a lot. It was always the headline. And, of course, it's not. It's simply an exchange fund. You put your money in exchange, red dollars for green dollars. End story. That was the whole thing. And so in terms of that, you know, I think the notion, or at least the insinuation that somehow, you know, taxpayers may somehow be affected, meaning the average person reading the newspaper worries that their taxes are going up. That is just so far from reality in this context. As you recall, the original premise was we would make a grant to the project. The issue was then, well, wait, what if the project does very well? The issue then was, then let's pay the grant back. There wasn't a mechanism to pay a grant back, as you recall. So the idea was, then how do we word it? And so it became a loan that might be forgivable if need be.
And so that was how that was how the original conversation took place. The fact that somehow taxpayers will be put on the hook or something like that is just a stupid fallacy. Second front that was opened up was this is somehow a bad business. There was a lot of discussion, one-liners in the press about coal is dead or this economy or some piece of that. The answer to that is really most strongly answered in two fashions. One is that if the $200 million of private investment goes through all of their diligence and decide they won't come in, the project will not happen. And so the best diligence that happens will be by those $200 million of institutions that are going to come in and do all of the diligence that is required for them to invest. And you'll be alongside them, piggybacking on all that diligence. And, you know, the counties will have their own counsel, and they will have their own financial advisor looking over the documents as they're prepared. We want to suggest a process whereby you all have a consistent and regular insight into how this happens, and get to sit at some of the meetings and review these things as they happen. So a very open and transparent process in that regard. But the second defense of the business, the bad business deal piece, is that we already transport 5 million metric tons of coal out of that gateway. Utah coal already goes out in two other locations in that gateway, much shallower depth. And when you go to a deeper depth, then you can load bigger ships, and it's a lower, again, cost per ton to transport. So the point is what I was at. Then why don't we just ship more out of those existing places? And the answer is we're out of capacity. That's the point. That's the point of adding some additional capacity to this tool. So, so in terms of the business transaction, it's not about what's happening in the industry in general. It's not about what's happening to a specific commodity here or there. It's about the entire equation when you take it out of the ground. Or you put it on the rail, handle it onto the rail, ship it by rail, take it off the rail, put it on a ship, deliver it. It's end-to-end delivery cost for the entire commodity. So as I said before, so much of that has to do with the short distance being it makes it a very good proposition. Second, our coal is in high demand to begin with, so you can't really compare our coal to a lot of other coals around the world, or even around the United States. Third, the particular situation with the terminal itself is when you go to the maximum depth for the Cape class vessel, you can now load and put as much on one vessel as you can possibly load. Where if you're up the Sacramento River somewhere and it's a lower shallow depth, you can get smaller ships, or you can only load a ship half, and you have to bring it down and try to top it off at the second terminal, and it just doesn't factor into a very economic. I mean, it's still economic, and as I said, it still makes money, but it wouldn't be doing it. So it's still an economic proposition. When you get to the very deep draft, it just speaks to a much, much better situation. The transaction.
It's a lot of the coal too, isn't it? It's a cleaner way. How much impact on the environment with the technology that we're using to load the bulk? I mean,
it's a very good question.
Yeah, it actually minimizes the impact.
It's a very good question. Coal is a regulated commodity, and our governor has gone on the record saying, folks, it's a legal product. It's transported all over this country every day. And it's regulated by all kinds of, the EPA has all kinds of things they say about what you can and can't do with rail cars and coal and other products like that. And so it's a regulated environment. There are, I think CLF, the terminal operator, talked about 610 specific items that they have to worry about in their regulatory statements as they operate this terminal. If someone were to come up with some additional factor, like, you know, what's happening from a health in this situation,
the EPA just said in writing, we would just write another regulation and make it mitigate that. We don't prohibit the interstate transport of these materials. These are all legal materials. So the EPA is already permitted, and the Bay Area Air Quality Management District said there's just not an issue with respect to health issues of transporting folks in the Bay Area. So, but you can understand where it's coming from. It's just this polarized, you know, situation. So there's no question about it. It's just a preference, in many ways, sensation. But it's fully permitted, as I said. I'm grateful to the people in this room who've put up with all this for the last year. Where's it gone? Well, and why is it taping here? I think most of you have read blow by blow what's happened as we've dealt with how to make this happen. That something like this is fully vetted down in the press and everywhere else. I don't think there's an item that hasn't been discovered, and many of you all have weathered countless numbers of grammar requests and whatnot, and we've all done that and put every bit of information we've got out about this. It's all out there. And so any issue that's out there is just discussed openly. And so one of the issues that we started talking about later last year was in our discussions, Treasurer Danson was there and Jay was there and Jim was there. We had some discussions with Tom Roberts and tried to discuss how to get a clear path, how to get him comfortable or the Attorney General's office comfortable with this. And so it was difficult at that time to really get a crystal clear path because while our counsel was giving us complete comfort that these issues were not a problem, as you all know, we were focusing our allocation of the $53 million on the revolving portion of your monies, which would have been already used for their primary purpose. But it still didn't keep us from a legal challenge. And so as we discussed it, it was already late enough in the year. We said, well, why not just exchange the money? You guys does it all the time, and it's just, you know, the state's got to have a pot of money somewhere that we could exchange in a way, because we exchange, the criticality of this exchange is that it's got to be exchanged with a pot of money where the person who are the agency that has that pot of money can then easily go use it on a qualifying use for the borough money. And that absolutely is UDOT. So the idea that it went into the transportation fund, the $53 million goes in and is held in a segregated account now, and that's going to be used to pay for rural roads. They have to, in order for it to be a complete wash in terms of an exchange, they have to be used on rural roads in the year they're taken. And that they would have had to use that sales tax money for those same rural roads. So where do you find that coincidence? Well, only in large numbers, and that's what you got. So they had enough rural roads needs that they were going to spend their sales tax money on in those two increments, and that's why it was done in two blocks. You got felt comfortable that they had those monies that they were going to spend in those two numbers to add up in those fiscal years. It made sense, and frankly, all we did was suggest that to Stuart Adams and you had the legislative folks roll with all the analysis, and they basically did it. Now, at this session, there were a lot of administrative back and forth with this staff and other staffs in the executive branch, and in terms of how to make it work. But it came upon us so quickly, we got the language back from the legislative offices and quickly had to then, I think in 4 days we made the rounds, we said, what does everybody think of this, and give us your inputs and you know, call us and get some feedback. So, but there were some adjustments made, and I think they were all good adjustments, I really do.
as we did this, it became clear that it could be, as Jay mentioned, and as Senator Oakley mentioned, a process that could be used in the future for any one of the major infrastructure projects that you all choose to set aside funds for or scale up for. And it would then take it to essentially this other account, and whatever you would expend would be sales tax money, completely free of any issues with respect to that. So it's frankly a very good tool for you to help you manage the way you want to the way you want to do things. And instead of just saying, well, we've got all these restrictions, now you have a tool where you can unrestrict some of this. It's not unlimited. It's really limited to the amount of money that you got would have spent in every calendar year on railroads anyway. So.
And I was just going to add in also those monies that are available through CIB into these larger infrastructure projects. And for those monies to go into this particular bill or this particular law, it has to go to the legislature every time. This was not just a one-time issue that covered us all for the rest of time. It has to go before the legislature every time. So that really is the solid mechanism that's now in place. If we have those projects that we want, those state dollars versus the federal dollars, now in statute there's the ability for groups, counties to be able to go do that. But it's all going to wrap back around here to the CIE board from where it starts. So.
So part of the discussion, I think, helps us grow out for you all to have is what happens with the next project, what has to happen in terms of applications, what has to happen in terms of setting that money aside, and the second piece is you can't run up there and explain something you don't have, so you're going to have to set enough aside and say, okay, we've got this for this project over here, that one. We'd like to avoid any issues on that as well. Next year, let's take it up and we'll get that exchange. There's the way the legislature can do it. But it seemed like it was pretty straightforward for them. It was simply a funding exchange, and they seemed happy to do it. As you all saw, the vote, I don't know if you all saw, but the votes were overwhelmingly in favor, and it was bipartisan. And the House, the Democrats were very outspoken, of course, in the Petition counties, very outspoken about the opportunity.
So am I hearing correctly is that, when we talk about an exchange for blue dollars, or it's really going from a federal requirements of how it's spent to the states?
There's no requirement on that.
Well, not required. It means requirement is the wrong word, but it's under the mechanisms or the guidelines that you're following. It really changes from having to follow federal restrictions or guidelines to state ones.
Sure.
So the way I read the statute is that the as you all know, right, the PCIB money can only be used for certain purposes that you all use for. And so pot of money A, which is $26 million this year, $27 million next year. So that money has the PCIB strings on it. So the money with the strings moves to the transportation account, where the transportation fund will use it for the same kind of projects that the PCIB can use it for. Then the money that was taken, the word earmarked, is that a bad word? The money that was already budgeted in the for transportation purposes
for rural roads.
So that money has now been replaced with your PCIB spring money. That money, which is general fund money, is going into the Strukturalized Infrastructure Fund, which the PCIB will now administer. This is, I don't know if this is a good time, Chair, for me to kind of, now that you've heard the exciting part, I can tell you kind of the boring technocrat part of the statute, which is what your job is now. But so now there's created a new throughput infrastructure fund, and it is funded with general fund money without the PCIB strings. I think that's the easiest way to explain it.
Any strings you would have come from local legislation and any guidelines you all put together for a couple of things. One is any sort of application. It's not like you're going to have a pad of applications here. We're talking about a handful of projects. and you've got to go every single year to the legislature to convert some of these dollars. So this is not a giant flow here. These are the larger things that you want to focus on. But the second thing is the diligence that you all want to undertake to do this. Now, that wasn't anything specific in the legislation, but it was made clear by the governor and by the lieutenant governor and all of their staff that they were very focused on making sure that a great amount of diligence was done. And I know they reached out to the treasurer and had a similar discussion, and were grateful that he was on the board. And would, whether he gets involved himself or staff or others, help everyone here make sure. And I know James pledged himself and said, look, why would any of us not want full involvement and diligence on these projects to make sure they're good situations for the distributors of the county.
Well,
question,
Jay, the legislation calls for the Mountain Mutual Plains, just the first year of
council, which let out, how does that impact our pledge, I guess, if you will, on the board relative to, because it was 63 up front, and now it's read out, and I think there are, you might have an answer, but my answer is, of course, council, is there are a lot of technical issues like that that we're going to have to, the board's going to have to decide how to resolve, right, because there's 53 million encumbered. There'll be things we'll have to work out with the Department of Finance, and we'll have to decide when to resolve. I haven't worked out in my own mind what's the best way
with the board. Yeah, and essentially, all along, all we've had, we don't have anything in writing. You all don't have anything in writing with the terminal. All it is you know, reasonable people in a room, very, you know, principles on there, and very, very, you've met them, very, very confident and straightforward folks dealing with very large projects and very large dollars, saying, so go get your money and bring it back, and we did last April, and it was like, okay, the money's here. Then there were questions about, you know, is it really completely, you know, able to be done, and so as they dealt with their issues on their end, it gave us time to deal with issues on our end, and we ended up through the legislation here. And now they really know. They really know it. But all of the detail between here and contracts have yet to be determined. Designs still have to be done. There's a $9.4 million total budget just to develop the terminal. It's a significant expenditure, not on your part, but on the sponsor's part there to do all the design work. They've got 10% design, they've got to go 100% design. And then they've agreed, I don't think I answered your question before, but they've agreed to do so much more than every other port in terms of covering every rail car, covering every container, covering storage, etc., making sure that it, you know, none of the product ever sees the sun. But those details are all kind of pledged on their end, and all the design elements are being done. And we'll need to put a process together so that you all are comfortable coming, you know, coming into meetings and helping with the diligence and seeing how this develops.
Not to bypass some of the legal that we want to have our Jim talk to, but the real question that should be asked is, what do we get because of the commitment that's there, and the timing mechanism really will work out, because we were in the right place at the right time, and we're able to step up and say, yes, as a state, as a community, we would like to do this. It got us that seat at the table to start these negotiations. And so not dollar one has been spent of these monies in this process of getting it to this point. And it won't be spent until we have a formal closing with the other $200 million. And I'll let Jim talk about, or Susan, that contractual process that we'll have to go through to do that. And so the mechanism of timing in the money will work out just fine. Just that commitment. The law has been signed. We have the money already set aside. So let me draw.
Which that's July 1st, right? For the statute. So
Exactly.
You
don't have money, you don't have money.
But from that money side of it, let's throw off three boxes if we could. One is the transportation or that kit dollar. One is the CID dollar that comes in every year to the state. Well, it comes in through the mineral revenues that the CID uses. And then we have our infrastructure fund over here that was already established that has the $53 million in. And so we've already tied together the federal money coming in with the strings attached that will, instead of coming to CID, they're going to go to the transportation, like Susan explained. And then monies from there are coming to this new fund. So that means, well, we keep hearing, well, the CID will be short. It won't, because it, again, as you look at that, that $53 million that we set aside a year ago, as $26 million flows into this other fund, and CID doesn't receive that $26 will need to flow back out of that other fund, or our infrastructure fund, back to keep the CID whole. And so in this perfect circle, we're using the same dollar amount. We are just moving the dollars so that they can be appropriately used.
Let me say one thing, because it is even, I mean, it's a bit confusing in terms of there's now three boxes that you described. It would have been easier to just take the $53 million and say, let's just exchange this. And can you do it in one go? Yes, let's know. You know, Carlos only had 26 this year and 27 next year. He felt very comfortable that he's already spending general fund.
Everyone know who Carlos is?
Carlos is here. For the record,
he's like Columbia and Brooklyn.
So, he's the pro skier. He'd rather hear him.
What's the difference between $2 million? You know, appropriated, you know, 51.
It was 53.
52.
It was reported 51. It was always 50.
Okay.
But let's just, so it would be easier to just take the 53 and exchange it. I think the legislative council folks said, you know, that's hard for us to go grab that. So what we'll do is we'll just divert the money that's coming in to the CID on a regular basis on these budget years. We'll divert 26 and 27, and CID can just reimburse themselves out of the infrastructure fund to stay the same. So it is a bit of a three-way instead of the two-way exchange. One complication is that the staff and the board funds itself a little bit from every dollar that does flow indirectly in that stream that comes in on a regular basis, and that was a fiscal concern, and everybody raised it, and that was some of the discussion around those days that the final language got put together. So language was inserted that said that for a particular project like this, part of that $3 million that was set aside for cost of the 53 could be used to reimburse those monies as calculated to make sure the CIB was whole from all of this and not somehow giving up a source to fund staff functions. Am I right there? Something?
Yeah, and I want to make a couple of comments. One, a clarification, because we talked a lot about the legislative process that transfers the $53 million. That isn't the only way we get money into the account. Is if, and I'm hoping this project pays back, program income off of anything funded out of this account comes back into that throughput infrastructure fund. So as money's come back, plus the interest earned on the money deposited there. So that all gets contained within the throughput infrastructure fund. It does not require the board to go back to the legislature to spend back out of that account, assuming there are retained incomes back into that account. So I think that's an important point to remember as we review any project in this regard and how it will pay it back, just like we do any other community impact work, traditional mineral lease project. The other thing I want to say, and we have talked a lot with the governor's office, I know he's been in contact with some interested parties on the issue of due diligence, and you know, I know we've had some conversations with board members as well. Our intent is to, as a staff, to develop a proposal for consideration of the next board meeting on a request for proposals for an independent consultant to the board to review the due diligence on the project. So if the applicant submits information related to the project as it moves forward, that we would have an independent consultant, traditional to any other project, we lack the expertise to review it. Not many of us are investment bankers, so an investment banking deal probably requires a different level of expertise than we traditionally have. So an RFP and engaging a consultant to do that review on behalf of the board, and also to start to outline the due diligence items that we're really looking for as a board. So we'll start to piece together some of the things. A lot of the things have been brought up by the governor. We talked a lot about them, but we'll start to develop, you know, a checklist of really what we're looking at as a board. So our intent as a staff, and I'd be happy to take any questions if you have in this regard, but our intent is to have that proposal developed for the next board meeting for consideration, and you can add, subtract, whatever there is, so the board can bring that clarity and define the process going forward on how, as the applicant submits further information, how what due diligence items need to be checked off before money gets deployed in the project, because I think that's always a lingering question out there for the public in that regard, and that will be our way to inform the public of how the process will proceed.
Just a quick comment, if I could, and Jonathan and Keith and I, we haven't had a chance to talk through this yet. So the state has defined its statute and under contract the municipal advisory relationship. And it's possible the scope of the analysis might exceed our advisor's capacity. As part of the conversation, as part of the proposal, a starting point needs to be looking at and having some discussion with the state's statutory and contractual municipal advisor, and then what sort of appendages or adjuncts to the process that we possibly place on to that contractually. They can be very constructive in assisting me, my office, and the board in making sure that we have all the pieces in place for robust due diligence and evaluation of the transaction.
And in that regard, I can get you guys, you know, I'll have some folks possibly a list of pretty much everybody we know that does econometrics work or any sort of studies that they'll put their name on, you know, that is a sort of a more market-grade kind of report. But we'll give you everybody. You guys can sort of have your advisors take a look at the list and sort of thing. But no question about it, when you have a heated oil pipeline or a transmission line or something like that, you've got to have some larger expertise. So one of the pieces we were asked, have there been any analysis done on this? It certainly has. Moffitt and Nickel was engaged by the terminal operator to do a very lengthy market study to basically tell all of these California entities that were also, you know, working from their end and wanting to feel comfortable about it, that these elements all do come together in a way that at least someone who understands ports and commodity movements and has a really fulsome economics group that does this all over the world, we give them that comfort. So those things have been done, and we'll have to put, you know, packages of those things together when it's final, and we'll sort it out, and everybody gets to read it. But yeah, you'll have to go hire those experts. I think it was wisdom to put that $3 million aside. I hope you'll spend it.
Now, I have about 3 or 4 just questions or points, if I could just go through them, if I can, just to let this clear up.
And then before you start, Mr. Chancellor, the rest of the board members have a number of questions as well. Would you like to take a break, or are we closing up the end of this, that you want to just plow through?
I just have one comment before we leave the break.
Okay, so you have one. Does anybody else have others? Why don't we take a few minutes break, because I've noticed people are getting up quite a bit, and then we'll spend another half hour, an hour with questions and things like that. Is that okay? 10 minutes.
Perfect.
Phone in this Mr. McKee says, that's on the county floor. If it's a coalition of counties, how does that payback responsibility fall?
Senate Bill 246 is clear that the loan made by the board for throughput infrastructure project can be non-recourse to the borrower. Those payables collate from the available net revenues of throughput infrastructure project. And so the expectation and intention of the loan here is for the repayment obligation to be bond lawyers to pay special and limited obligation of the loans or the loan that we are on their behalf. It is limited so that the net revenues generated by the operation of the investment project.
And bond, again, what was that called? A
special and limited obligation.
I'm unfamiliar with
it. So a lot of the loans that the board makes are for say water projects, and those are typically going to be retained out of water revenues from state local government, as opposed to backed by full chain for credit and tax and power, full general obligation. So the special and limited obligation concept indicates that it's not the general corporate obligation of the borrower, but instead is to be repaid from specific revenue streams.
I want to throw something out on that from a philosophical standpoint. When we all discussed this way back when, the idea was loaded originally by several of the counties that were talking about projects. We can't put these kinds of projects on the books for that very reason. How would we do that? We would love to be able to make an investment and then divide the income between the participating counties for the efforts we've taken, right-of-way acquisition and permitting, and all the stuff you do to make these projects happen. But you can't ask them then also put it on our books. I think a lot of the misunderstanding at the legislature also and the executive branch a little bit through this process was, how are we to ascertain that these loans will be paid back? As you all recall, these were originally supposed to be grants because of that very reason. Let's make it a grant. Let's not have that obligation. And then still do the diligence and still get the repayment, but not have any repayment come to CIB, which would mean the full amount of the principal loan would come back to the counties as well. It was a lot. And as you recall, Gordon said, no, I want to have the repayment. If there's upside and you can pay the counties, pay me. Pay us. Pay yourself back and put it into that account. So the idea was to make it a loan, and then it was that it can be very flexible. And there were two elements of that. One is that at the time it was constructed, it would be a 2% number in terms of the interest rate, but then also that there would be a complete deferral of anything until the project was in commercial operation if you actually afford to do so. Those were two elements. But when you look at those from just a complete third party looks at that and says, what kind of a loan is that? It's like, well, it's actually a super grant. It's not a loan. If you start with the basic premise that you all started with, which was it's a grant, but if it does well, we're all going to get paid back again, and it will generate income. That's a different philosophical base from which to look at this. So you don't really need the county backstop to any of this, and you can do a special purpose obligation to revenue bonds to repay it in that way. When it was taken to the legislature, some of the folks in that discussion said, well, how about something for us? How about something for the state? Can we get some of this? And there was discussion about fingers in that. And I think you heard from Senator Okerlund that discussion restored me. And they said, you know what? Let's just facilitate this. So there was no haircut, like you got kicked 15% off the top of a case like this. And there was no cutting the state in for any income stream or the repayment amount. And so, as Jonathan said, it goes back in. When it gets repaid, it's going to go back into the infrastructure account as repaid money. So then you'll get to do it again with another project.
I'd say, along Commissioner McKee's point, the board has taken one action on this particular item right now, and that's approving the loan, kind of those basic terms of the loan, the 2%, 30 years. But I think there's a little bit of deferral mentioned in that particular motion. So anything outside of that would require new action of the board and would require them submitting documents and us doing the due diligence to make sure what we would term as return on investment is the right return that this board is looking for, whether that's financial in nature or whether it's an economic value to the community, and that's what the board feels is important. I think those are all items to be determined through the due diligence process. So I think that's where a lot of confusion lies, because right now it's approved as a loan, 30 years, 2.5%. So everybody's talking in those terms, and there's no other terms until requested and reviewed and approved by the board.
And I will speak for Jay, but I've heard the county say over and over again to you all in this very room, it does require another action. It's coming back before you all for discussion. And even though the legislature has said, this will happen, it was really more on the exchange and defining the project, et cetera. It was always the county's intent, the county's collective intent to bring it all back and do that review.
Because it was set as a set aside for the project.
Yeah.
I guess the only point that I'm really just making is I do think there would be value in defining. Because at some point in time, that's going to have to be either on the four counties or on an organization or someplace. So I think that would be valuable to define that when it's appropriate.
And we originally started down that road with the application was originally for the four counties. We started down that road even with Jim to start to formulate a new entity. And then looking at the time frame, and six counties was just starting. We knew we potentially had other options, and so we didn't go down any further on that. I kind of became the defunct spokesperson for the counties. And anyway, it was always intended that it had to come back that way because that then affected the very nature of the transaction.
Jeff, while we have your attention, one of the things that keeps coming to my mind is the timing of all of this. A lot of people are acting like this is happening. You've described a very long and drawn out process. In your experience, based on your knowledge of this project, what does our timing look like? I mean,
It's a great question. And frankly, what are we doing this week? You know, what's happening now that we've got all the approvals? That'd be on the top of my list. I've tried to describe what happened the last year, and frankly, the only major event other than sort of weathering the storm. There have been four bills put in the California legislature, I think, by the senator from Berkeley. I'm not exactly sure of the details of the bills, but it's essentially to try to stop the project by not allowing the transport by rail through the state of California of these kinds of things, and of course that would be very problematic from an interstate commerce clause standpoint. So I personally don't think there's much in terms of rights on those. The city of Oakland was sued by the opponents, some of the environmental opponents, asking the city to do something about this and not let this happen. But they had basically had through all their permitting issues and had no more standing. So in many ways, it was out of the control of anyone who didn't want to have jump in there and exercise the control. The city still had, under its obligation with the overall site developer, which was CCIG, we had one of their representatives here in the April meeting. They still had to then finalize their lease and turn the service site over to CCIG, and that has taken place. So the city, notwithstanding all of this, the lawsuit was dropped. They said, we'll see what we can do. There's probably not much. And then they went ahead and signed their lease with the overall developer on the site. So a lot of that $550 million you all saw that was coming in from federal and state of California money to prep the sites, the overall site, the entire area, is being spent. It was already being spent, so we saw the project going on. So it's all still continuing forward. With respect to the terminal, the TLS and the operator has to now sign the lease with the developer, and then they have an option that they have to actually sign the lease with the developer. It requires them to write some checks, some pretty substantial checks to get that done. We expect that to take place in the next couple of months, but they're still working the details out, and part of that is dealing with some of the fallout. With city officials, and whatnot, just to make sure everybody's comfortable with it. A lot of this is numbers of jobs and the labor issues and things that have to kind of be worked out on the sides and such. One of the things the executive branch has asked for is a schedule. So we're pressing for a schedule on this. I'm guessing the schedule looks like, to spend that kind of money and get those studies, it's probably, we'll be back here next April for final. This is pretty serious stuff. But that's none of the $53 million gets spent on any of that. This is you're not shooting the moon until there. We've been asked on several occasions, would the state be interested or would the county be interested in sort of helping out on the front end? The answer is always been no. When I'm asked, don't you think that the answer is no? It's just never going to happen. And all the money's there, and when the project's ready to go, they'll sign it. We'll sign it. We'll sign it. That's from a timing perspective, I don't know if that answers everybody.
Well, it will start. Construction by the developer, is that at least a year out as well? Are they doing things now?
Sidecrest's going on now in terms of rail coming in and sign everything, but that's off the actual terminal site. The actual terminal won't actually be started until the money's in the bank. Then they can actually fund a construction account and go forward. But to do that, you've got to have guaranteed maximum prices on your construction contracts. And it's all got to come together. You've got to have those counterparties all signed up to do
it. And once construction begins, how long is that process?
Yeah, I think they shared with us 2019, is that correct?
Yeah, they said it would be 15 to build out as far as the facility goes.
I'm hearing though now, some of the white products folks, the soda ash folks, want to go into production in 2017. To do that, it's probably a little easier for them because they can clamshell it right off the pavement. They can just get a crane and fill a barge and start. It won't be this high tech ultra thing, but we're not committed till the very end of the whole project. So they may actually figure out how to get into revenue production, help pay for some of their front end costs by handling some product over the key right away. The first time I took a waterfront tour in the port of Chicago, which I represented the mayor there for a number of years on the port of Chicago, I was on a barge and we were going by the dock and I saw this big rusty clamshell grabbing a bunch of a pile of white stuff on the dock. And I turned to the guys on the tugboat and I said, I don't recognize that commodity. And they said, oh, That's white processed sugar. And they said, what are they doing with it? And he said, he's loading it in that screw auger over there, and it's going into that warehouse over there. So what do they do with it? He said, that's the Tootsie Roll factory. They were taking sugar right
with a rusty question and stopping it in the tissue roll thing, and it would go in and boil, and then they would screw it into this chocolate syrup. And they would make tissue rolls. I haven't had a tissue roll since that day. Even though they cooked it at a very high temperature. So you can operate right on the dock, I guess, with certain stuff.
Are you saying sugar is dirty too?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that, just kind of following up with that, is that the question has been asked, well, if it's such a good deal, why does the state even involve in it at all? And it goes back to some of that discussion that Senator Oakland had with the public-private partnerships. But the thing that we get, that question that I asked, the question we should ask, what do we get for this, is the seat at the table, is the capacity of throughput to that port. So if it's a $250 million estimated project, and for $50 million involvement, we get 50% throughput, that's a pretty good bargain in and of itself. And the other thing to realize that's been falsely reported is that this is a loan to a private company. That is not the case either. This is monies that, whether it's a new county organization or a sixth county, these are investments that are going in as that ownership. And so we are not subsidizing somebody else. We're looking for the return to the CID, to the state of Utah. We're looking for the return that the county might have. In terms of that, I think of that as mitigation. Going back to coal and so forth, if coal falls off and we reach that cliff, it's really hard to do economic development in a ghost town. And so what we're doing here is buying time for not only transition, but also development of other industry, and we're also shoring up a portion of the population in the state of Utah that is being paid a living wage. The income is very good. It is not those wages that are associated with sub-minimal living standards. And so that gives us time to make sure that we are prepared and diversified in the future, which I think is the model that all of us have to look at. We've seen it, up and down. We see the cycles all the way from the basin product to the county, the Carbon County product. And we live and die by those cyclical nature of what those products are. And so we may be struggling right now, but I've seen this, I don't know how many times in my life. I've lived through that in businesses, and you just learn to plan, you learn to save, you learn to take care of the things while things are good, and then you buckle down and hold on when things come back out. So it is mitigation, which is really what this board has always been about, mitigation in those impacted areas. And so that's really what we're getting. Seat at the table, 50% capacity, preferred rates of return, and all those things obviously have to be negotiated, and that's why we'll be looking to Jim to help us with those type of negotiations. But it's a big deal for the state of Utah. Otherwise, the governor's office or the lieutenant governor and the legislature would not be supporting this. I mean, you think about what that means for the state of Utah, like Doug already mentioned. An inland state to have access to the world. I mean, it's a big deal. It really is.
Can I just say one thing, too? I've said it in several private conversations with you all, but I came into the investment banking business in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, I guess you could say, and the Intermountain Power Project was coming up. And I don't know if any of you were around when that happened, but the Southern California utilities came in en masse and said, we are desperate for electric power. And so they went to the legislature, and they specifically got the legislature. They had to get the legislature to sit down and give them a separately chartered entity, which is the Intermountain Power Project, to do what they're doing out there. And basically, the coal-fired power plants that were put in the state were part of that social contract that those conversations were all about. We will come to your state. You burn your coal. You have the coal jobs. You have all these benefits from the economy. But you got to burn it in your state, and we'll take all the power. That was the social contract. But nobody's said anything a few years over the last few years as they've
walked away from the social contract. It's not a retrofit of those plants where they have to completely rebuild them for gas. That's a new social contract, but nobody said, we're going to walk away from these. By the way, Jay, what's going to happen to your, your miners? What's going to happen to your economies when we do so? Nobody said that. Just walked away. So in 2026 and 2029, when the full contracts are up, that's the root, that's the basis for why this discussion happened. 5 million metric tons going through that terminal is like a fraction of what mined. I mean, just the word that the study was like 30 million metric tons in the state. I don't remember what the number was, but it's a 26 million metric tons. So 5 million metric tons really is helpful, but it's not everything. It doesn't replace what, what was walked away from by that state in their actions. And so in a way, it's a bit ironic that we're sort of opening the door and saying, okay, fine, we've got to go find some other place to replace it. And as Jay has mentioned on a number of occasions, this is a transitional thing. We get 65 years of the throughput for 5 million metric tons. That helps, but it doesn't do everything. It doesn't replace it. And so this just buys time to figure out, how to transition. But it's mitigating. It's doing something as opposed to just letting it wash over us. And
does not preclude us from taking products from other states either, does it?
No.
We have the ownership of that deep water part of it, so even if some of our things dry up, we can still contract for access to that portion from other English states, not even our own, but we can still do that.
You can go.
I want to sell it with alfalfa hay.
Okay. Hay from San County
would love that.
Jeff, ports like most transportation goes both ways. So when the ships come in, what are they offloading?
In this case, it's a strict export terminal. There's no real way. It's not like containers where you can pull a container on and throw a container off. The facilities are direct load or unload. So if you wanted to do some imports, you'd have to actually dedicate a portion of the site and have an import site. It's not the same. It's not to say that you couldn't, and there absolutely could be the demand for it, but this country is a net exporter.
Yeah.
we net export a lot of things.
So in your experience, the ships fell over the Pacific Rim and come back empty?
Yeah, there's nothing else you can put in them.
Mm-hmm. Unlike the containers when we were down there, there were three container ships offloading. They're at the port on the other side, which is the container. The bulk of that army thing is just container operations. So this is 30 acres of old.
Yeah, this is actually a little teeny triangular piece right on the base of the Bay Bridge that has been used the past few years for the staging area for Caltrain rebuild of the Bay Bridge, and now moved off of it. So.
This is a personal note. If you have these powers, this was my front yard for 2.5 years. I was in the Coast Guard on the Yerba Buena Island. And I went
right at
every day for 2.5 years or something. Actually, I think I'm due for a visit back to San Francisco or the Bay Area. It's not the most scenic part.
No, the treatment plant is right next door. Sewer treatment plant is right next door, so it's perfect for industrial use.
I'll tell you, the commerce and the transportation down to that port is heavy. It's a fantastic site. It's a great port.
It's deep water, and that's everything. It's the deep water. There's only a few places. As Jay said, in that case, a lot of commodities these days are containerized. I'd be surprised if most of the hay cubes in Sampi are transported in containers that go on container ships. A lot of the export now happens in containerized volumes. But in the Bay Area, their big export, which they fill the ships coming in with television sets, they fill it with produce from the Central Valley, all containerized.
Yeah.
It's a natural export market.
It was interesting that the California wine market uses containers to ship in all the states. Right?
Mm-hmm. Can I get in a few tankers?
You know, it's interesting. I represented a group in Puerto Rico that moved. That they were having a bit of a discussion about a rum facility, and it's all about the molasses, and that actually is done in very large bladders. And they can take the molasses.
I was on to something.
Yeah, you were. Fruit juice and molasses all goes in bladder containers.
I will say, as a former accounting officer, the stability and buoyancy issue with fluid shifting around the ship in the ocean, I'm not sure I want to be piloting the vessel around a lot of that. That's a special thing, for sure.
Other questions for
Mr. Trigger Dance to threw something out. I a number of you have seen this site. I would expect that all of you should probably see it at some point here. So we'll as we have these, our thought, we have sort of discussed this with the county team, and actually the Attorney General's folks, just in terms of how to do a review of documents as they come in, so we can have you all a part of this on an ongoing basis, and what the best way to do that is. So we're sort of formulating the ideas in terms of how to put sort of a standing group together, but have you all invited in, in certain terms or whatever, to take a look at things as you may want to, and then it's not all presented on the last minute. Here's the whole package tied up. It has been reviewed all along the way in a transparent way for you all.
We look forward to your return visit.
So do I.
So thank you both very much.
Did you miss anything, Chairman, so you need to add to
this meeting would be, I think Susan may want to have a little bit of discussion about implementing the provision of Senate Bill 46, and I was curious if it would be helpful for me to provide a sort of a brief overview of the new legislation and how it plugs into the existing CID statutes, but if that's not necessary. I've been in a lot of discussions with...
No, we would welcome that. Candace and I had a meeting with core attorneys just yesterday on this issue, so let's throw another one into the mix.
I'll be brief. I've been in a lot of discussions with Jay and Jeff over the last year and a half around this project, and they are as loquacious as they are elegant, so I'm used to not saying the word in advance. Sorry. So the Senate Bill 246, in terms of the Community Impact Board statutes, adds one new definition to the definition section of the bill, and then it adds two new sections to the CID statute. It otherwise leaves all of the existing statutory provisions governing the use and application of general relief and act monies to within the statute. The new definition is infrastructure project, and that's defined to include four different types of facilities. One is a bulk commodities ocean terminal. Second is a pipeline for the transportation of liquid or gaseous hydrocarbons, so oil or gas. Third is electric transmission lines and related electrical facilities. And the fourth is a short line freight railroad and ancillary facilities to that rail line. The definition also includes very broad language that is intended to give us, in the context of the port terminal, the ability to structure our investment into the port in the manner that best protects the interests of the state counties, the board, and the state. So there's a very broad definition of the type of that investment. We think that will enable pretty much any type of structure that we could come up with. There's been a new Section 308 to the CID statute that creates the throughput infrastructure fund, and it provides what the sources of funding are for that fund. That fund does have a, like the existing permanent community impact fund, does have a revolving quality because of the loan repayments coming back into the fund over time. Those are then available for relending. And then the second new section is the provisions regarding the administration of the throughput infrastructure fund by the board. These are very, in general, very similar to the same sorts of considerations that apply to the application of Mineral Leasing Act money. That section does specifically direct the board to administer the fund, determine provisions for loan repayments, establish criteria for awarding loans and grants, and additional enabling legislation around that. This again, we tried to draft it with a mixture of sort of generalities and specificities to give us the best possible authorization for all of these different types of projects. So,
I
do, because I provided tools that you're talking that they can utilize. This is the white, this is the bill. Through, as you read through the bill, it will talk, and these are color-coded. What he's just talking about is 308 and 309. So if you want to follow what he's talking about, this is how it affects CID.
Right, and thank you again. And, you know, the total, let's see, you know, it's about 70 lines of the bill. The bill in total was 26 pages. There were a lot of other sections that were affected to allocate and reallocate the funding for the throughput infrastructure fund, but the provisions that are specific to the CID and the statute are only about 70 lines or about a page and a half of the bill. So I would strongly recommend that the members of the board read through it. It's frankly pretty easy to read. We try to keep it as plain English as we could. Before I turn it over to Susan, my other observation would be is while it may be next April before we're back here seeking final approval from the board, there's a lot of work that needs to get done. We've had good preliminary introductions and preliminary opportunities to review documentation regarding the port terminal, but we have not begun either genuine due diligence around this project or genuine negotiation of transaction terms. That will easily consume the better part of 12 months to get this transaction properly vetted, privileges, and structures for the benefit of the counties, the board, and the state. So,
one more thing. Would you please keep Bill Prater in those conversations? Because he's the one that's going to have to verify that this board's money, as it goes out, is, you know, all the checks and balances that you worked with him before, but keep him in those positions.
And for the record, Bill Prater is bond counsel for the board, and he'll be involved when we get to that point in this project, whether that's 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. Thank you, Jim. Susan, do you have
anything to add? Yeah, I think Jim covered it pretty well. I will now distill, my very extensive law school education into these two principles for you. There's two concepts in the statute that relate to what the board has to do. There's the shall and the may. Right? The shall means you must. The may says you can if you want to. And the thing, obviously what this requires the board to do, and in spite of all the conversation we've had today about changing the color of money, all of which I agree with, I mean, this is a new territory for the board as I see it. I mean, you are now going to be administering a fund that is without the very narrow strictures of the community impact board. So, in my mind, you have a really exciting new program that this statute has created. So, you must make grants and loans from this fund for a throughput infrastructure project, which is one of the four things that were referred to, four being one of them. You have to use the money to either provide a loan or a grant, very similar to your PCID. And I think the things that I want to focus on, which I think are on your green sheet, are really what the board's initial duties here are to, you know, administer the fund in a way that keeps a portion of the fund revolving. The board at some point can decide what portion they want it to be. Determine provisions for repayment, establish criteria for awarding loans and grants, and criteria for determining eligibility. And all of this feeds into the due diligence discussion we've been having, right? The board, not today, you can't do anything today, it's not on the agenda, but the board should be thinking about, and we need to have a discussion about how and what manner you want to exercise your discretion here. And I'm happy to help you either way, whether you want to come up with these criteria now, I mean, the one thing you have is time, right? Because your money doesn't vest until July. Project is in formation, but you should be thinking about, as an investor in this project, what do you want to see? And that will help the applicant determine what they need to do. And obviously, a lot of due diligence is going to be happening by the other investors. How much do you want to piggyback on that? How much do you want on your own? It sounds like we're hiring a consultant. So, and you as a board just have to decide how do you want to structure the exercise of your discretion, and I can help you there. You know, then it does have this provision in line 115 on your green form to restructure or forgive. Do you want to think ahead of time objectively about what the conditions would be for that? You are required under line 120, to review the proposed uses for a loan or a grant before approving it. You can condition your approval on certain assurances. You want to think about how you want to exercise your discretion there. There's long-term, a lot of these things will be in the financial documents that we create as the deal gets flushed on its loan, or a deal gets flushed on its loan. And there are certain requirements about how to do it. So I'm happy to help in any way that you want to help you exercise your discretion once you start with that. It sounds like, and I've already been talking to Mr. Bird and Mr. Holt about how we can accomplish giving you the most information while protecting anything that's protectable under the Government Records Act of Management. I mean, presumably, some of their investors may not want their complex financial data made public for a variety of reasons, and I'll help them work, and Wade and I will help them work through the legality so that you have maximum exposure and you can do as much to go.
I want to thank the Attorney General's Office, Wade and Tom, who have been working many long hours on this. It's much appreciated there. They are definitely looking out for the best interest of the Community Impact Fund Board, so we appreciate that.
The other thing I want to say is I feel like there are technical details here because if you don't know who is going to be the bond, who's going to apply for the bond, how you're going to perform your entity, there'll have to be some kind of change of applicant. We're going to have to figure out how to, paper the unencumbrance of the money that's encumbered once the other money comes in. I can work with the board to figure out the right way to do that. I haven't really come to a clear feeling in my own mind about how we should do that, but we should definitely do it in a, transparent, financially approved way. I think of what that is.
The question on that, would that be something, is there room at our retreat to, it'd be nice to kind of have a flow chart, someplace where we're just kind of, at least kind of start putting out those general principles, how this all fits for us. And
sure. Well, we'll certainly be discussing this at some extent at that point. I think it's important for everyone to realize that this is a long process. There are many steps in this process. We realized that when we embarked on this journey a year ago. And if you were looking at the map and we were going from California to Maine, well, we're almost to Utah. So we've got a long ways to go. There's a lot of due diligence. We have a lot of good minds working on this, and we plan to engage more good minds and keep everyone on this board informed and involved in all those decisions. It's a very heavy responsibility that the legislature and the governor have placed on this board. We are holding the bat on this. Let's not forget that. It's our stewardship. It's our responsibility.
If this is successful, there'll be a lot of people to take credit for it. And if this is not successful, guess what? You have to look across the table. So let's make sure it's successful. And I have full confidence in the board and in the project. I think it's a good thing.
I want to say that I think we're all sharing this, that in the interest of the taxpayer, I want to make clear that despite the fact these funds are not sourced directly from taxpayers, when we manage investments of taxpayer dollars, we generate interest income, and I say, when talking about the important things we do in our office, we save taxpayers indirectly, right? If you earn $60 million in interest, that's a revenue source back to governmental entities that you don't have to seek tax revenues. So there is interchangeability there. So even though these are not taxpayer dollars per se, I think we have the same sacred responsibility with these dollars, and stewardship is at the core of all that we do here. And I look at these dollars as I look at these dollars the same as I would taxpayer. What did I just say? Taxpayer funded dollars, right? I just don't want. And then also, I understand legal concerns, but also in protecting the taxpayer and out of concern for the taxpayer's interests, we should have maximum practicable transparency around all of these things. And I know we all share in that, but I just wanted to keep my views to those issues.
Appreciate that.
And if I can just let Helen know, right, no matter where the money comes, when you're sitting at this table, you have to be sharing, you need to steward the money in the public interest, right?
Anyway.
Yeah. Actually, Kathy does put general fund money in this account, so think of it as you can support that advice.
Well, I'm sure an oil and gas company, it feels like it's taxpayer money. They're paying
4.5%
of whatever they make.
If you take, you know, Treasure Dancing, if you take $5 million, you're just 10% on the $50 million over 65 years. It's $385 million or something in terms of public through those close counties or whatever, you know, what it ends up being, but that's a lot. And you absolutely, as Jay said, one of the concerns we've had right from the get-go is to make sure that the first insurance, that's what we really have a little bit of access to, and maybe not be greedy on the top end of that insurance. But yeah.
At least we forget that the top 50% of mineral revenue funds goes to the federal government. 51% of the federal government. So to be disingenuous to what it does for a nation is very, very
interesting. You have a 1% administration.
That's the federal government could make as good use of those revenues as I think we do.
Well, we tend to keep it that way.
Mission prayer.
Yep. Yeah. Other comments or discussion? I greatly appreciate you making time for this meeting. Again, somewhat unorthodox for this group, but I personally feel that I'm very well spent, and I hope you feel the same. And look forward to seeing you all next month at a regular meeting for our Chief of Fight Chancellor. So thank you for allowing this meeting to happen here, because I think we're able to kind of get into depth a little bit more than we said at a regular meeting. And, you know, this is a very important project in the state of been valuable to be able to have enough time. I don't know that we've really ever had enough time to really just talk about this, but thank you for it.
I just have a quick question. On our agenda, and it's not so much, and I don't have any questions, but we have new rules. So are you going to be obligated to create a new rule now?
No, that's an interesting subject.
I agree with you about
that, right? It's on the agenda. So, usually when there's a new kind of project or mission, there is rulemaking authority in the bill, and the board does have rulemaking authority already in statute, but not for this project, and there wasn't rulemaking authority was not added to the bill. So, you know, just like
Susan Eisenman's personal philosophy on rules versus policy, not necessarily the official opinion of the Attorney General's office, right? I mean, usually how I view rules is rules are the kind of things that you promulgate when you're when an agency is going to take action that's business facing or facing out to the community, and policies are generally internal decisions, right? But the Administrative Rulemaking Act does. But let me say it this way, you know, rulemaking, sorry, we're trying to help them, we're still in the room, good, so he can hear me say this on the record. You know, rulemaking is essentially a delegation of legislative power, right? The legislature makes the laws, and the legislature delegates to an agency the authority to make rulemaking, to make rules, which have the effect of law. So it's like a legislative delegation. So we have to take that seriously, and in this case, there was no express legislative delegation. So we have to decide whether there's an implied legislative delegation, and that's always what's implied is always a grayer area than what's expressed, right? However, that said, whatever it is the board decides to do to exercise its discretion under this new statutory scheme, you know, I would recommend that you do it objectively and transparently. And with public input. I mean, that's what rulemaking requires, and if you, no matter what you do, if you satisfy those three things, right, then that increases public confidence in what you do. You're not obligated. You don't have rulemaking authority.
And I guess there's some reason we felt that we needed more than we have. We could always, you know, request and see what the legislature, you know, because they don't have time on this.
Okay, so we talked a lot about this internally, because there are some requirements to set forth the criteria, et cetera, which is a policy piece of what we're going to lay out. And certainly from what I'm hearing, sounds like we could accomplish that by drafting the policies that will be adopted in our program guidance and rules, our internal facing document. We could easily hold a public comment period regarding that in a board meeting and probably satisfy all the conditions without having to go through the rulemaking process if we don't have authority to really enter into. So I think that's kind of the direction as a staff we would put forth the board. So Canvas has been working really hard on kind of starting to draft the criteria, and that, you know, when it says rule there, that's what we're really talking about is the things that we're required to do under the statute, you know, starting to put some meat behind that. So we're drafting criteria, and whether that shows up in a rule or the policy program guidance, that's kind of what we're deciding right now. But again, I think we're leaning more towards since we don't have rulemaking authority, just having that be program guidance of the board to potential applicants. That's what they would see if this is the criteria for issuing funds out of the system.
I think the idea going forward, right, is that any applicant for this pot of money would have a clear understanding of what's required. Okay.
Now, when we say this pot of money, are we talking only specifically about the $53 million?
Well, about the throughput infrastructure fund, which is created by statute, which could potentially be funded in the future, but currently isn't.
And
that's how I'm thinking.
Keep in mind. If it's paid back, there'll be money there that you have to think about what you're going to do.
Maybe you might want to think about, right, if there is
not
money.
Not briefly, but there's.
So the second part of that is that four things were outlined: support, pipeline, power corridor, and the rail.
Right. Those are the four types of projects that are eligible to be funded from this fund.
Okay. So if something, so if there was another type of project that came in, it wouldn't be able to qualify under this. It'd have to go on to some other mechanism.
If it wasn't one of those four things, it would not be eligible to be funded out of this fund?
Correct.
Can I
say most of the legislature relative to the approved?
Which you have to do anyway to exchange the dollars so that there's lots of money after that.
Yes.
I think we made the point that in case somebody, what would happen if you couldn't somehow maintain $63 million on this project, you've got three other definitions that you could spend this money on, right? You know, if they just something you want to do.
Because for my clarification, we have our infrastructure fund that the board is satisfied, then the legislature has put together this other fund.
The throughput.
Sorry, and are we talking about the throughput fund?
I'm talking about the throughput infrastructure fund.
Okay,
you
thank you.
Snapping the moniker.
I just want to make sure I was clear with the legislature.
Correct. The board did prepare a rule for the infrastructure fund. I used those guidelines and a lot of conversation back and forth with the night. And other attorneys were involved. There is a draft of language. If the board wanted to look at that and look at it as a policy, we can make it a policy. But as far as rulemaking, that's up to the board to decide if they want to pursue the rules.
That's very implicit rulemaking.
Yeah, very implicit.
So, Jan, you used the term infrastructure fund. Are you talking about board infrastructure fund or legislative?
Very funny. No.
Just making sure I'm following.
The infrastructure fund is in rule, and that's
right. We've already done that.
All
right.
The new rule would be the throughput.
The throughput. Okay. We need to give them really good names for this one.
Just look at infrastructure fund being in the board mineral lease family, and throughput means it's throwing it out.
You said infrastructure. That's why it's different. That's why. What's the coolest?
Well, there's infrastructure satisfied fund, and there's throughput infrastructure.
We just need to make it clear.
One thing that is distinctively different is the set aside that the board did not add a fund number within state charter accounts. That's just an internal tracking, an internal set aside, so to speak. This statute actually creates a separate and distinct fund.
Numbers fund.
And it's had that conversation with the division of finance over a few days. What number that would be. It's a separate number of funds that would be in charge of funds. So we would have done that way.
Just be thankful to the people like Cam Chinkasin who figure all that, those numbers out so that you don't have
to. Any further discussion? Any further motions? That's a good one. Yes, ma'am?
Yes.
Don't forget this.
Did you want to talk about the recruits?
Yeah.
All right. We want to jerk you together.
Yeah, we have a retreat coming up in Monticello. Wednesday, June the 8th. For those that would like to, at the risk of getting in trouble with my wife, I made a decision today that she and I will host a Dutch oven dinner and storytelling time at our home in Monticello Wednesday evening for those that arrive early enough, probably about 6:30. We have a home on the edge of town that looks up at the mountain and have a big couple thousand square foot redwood deck that we can accommodate everybody that would like to come. But it'd just be helpful if we had an idea how many people were coming, whether you're bringing your wives or your husbands or somebody with you.
It depends on two things. What kind of story are you going to tell us?
Well, I'm going to tell you the history of San Juan County and how Monticello was settled, and we'll talk a little bit about the cowboy companies. No, I won't do anything I've done before. So we're just going to have kind of hamburgers and Dutch oven potatoes and Dutch oven cobbler and things like that. So, that'll be Wednesday evening. Then on Thursday for dinner, most of you remember Steve Simpson. He has a restaurant in Bluff called the Twin Rocks. where you can get an authentic Navajo taco. So we're going to go down there, and we're going to go visit the Bluff Fort, and maybe even look at... And look at some of the projects that we funded in Bluff on Thursday evening. And, that's just kind of what we're thinking about right now. And so if board members and staff members who are coming want to participate on lunch evening, we'd love to have you come to our house and
can we help you with defraying
your
costs?
Bringing what?
Can we help defray some of
the
costs?
No,
we will lose
$27
million.
San Luis County will help me. We're glad to host the board and the staff. San Luis County is kind of a long ways away. It's not as easy to get to as St. George. But it's still part of southern Utah. We're kind of the high desert. St. George is the low desert. So we want you to have a good experience kind of on the Monticello and want you to see some of the things that are going on there. So if you'll just work with Candace and let her know how many people are coming, and I'll know if I need to kill another
broadcaster. I just make you some noise.
You have this in your... in your red folder, we will make some changes to that. Dinner on Your Own will be optional dinner with Bruce Adams, storyteller extraordinaire.
Yes.
And I'm also aware that tentatively we have a 6-county infrastructure on Friday morning. We're going to change that to one of the Thursday sessions. So watch for this to come back for you. This is a draft. And I appreciate all the work that's being done by Monticello and San Juan County and Rick Pearson and
Kelly
Pearson, him too.
Sure.
So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the support. Yeah.
Commissioner Potter?
Sure. I take a motion to adjourn.
Thank you, everyone. Adjourn. Can I come on?